supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Support for Voices in the Family is made possible in part by the generous support of Devereaux, the nation's largest nonprofit provider of behavioral health care for children, adolescents, and adults with developmental and intellectual disabilities, behavioral disorders, and mental illness. Devereaux operates at 15 centers in 11 states throughout the country.
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Welcome to Voices in the Family. Most agree, tomorrow's election is historic. But what makes it so? What makes something this important? And what is it that makes it so for you? Is it race and gender? Are you voting based on fear of the past? Or are you voting based on fear of the future? Are you voting based on deeply held values or just a gut feeling about trust? Who votes and why? And why will tomorrow be different? Complicated questions. We'll have answers to all of them from my two guests on today's show. One of them, they're both professors at Annenberg. Joining me on the phone is Michael Dellacorpini. He's the dean at the Annenberg School and at the University of Pennsylvania. He's also author of A New Engagement, Political Participation, Civil Life, and the Changing American Citizen. Michael, welcome to the show.
It's a pleasure to be here.
I'm also joined here in the studio by John Jackson. He's an associate professor of communications and anthropology at the University of Pennsylvania and at the Annenberg School. He's the author of Racial Paranoia, The Unintended Consequences of Political Correctness. John, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Dan.
And you're welcome to join the conversation also. As always, our number is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. Michael, before we get to the decision-making issues, let's talk about who is making these decisions. Historically, citizen participation is about 50%. That's pretty small. How's it compared to other democracies? I know in Israel it's up over 80, close to 90%.
Well, that's right. Turnout in presidential elections over the last number of elections has been hovering around 50%. That's actually both lower than used to be the case in the United States many decades ago, and also lower than most other advanced industrial democracies. Now, in fairness, some other countries have required voting, but even in those countries that don't require it, turnout generally is higher in other advanced industrial democracies than in the United States.
So what's up with us?
Well, I mean, there's different arguments that are made. One is the positive spin is that when things are going relatively well in a country and a democracy has been established for a long time, that people feel comfortable enough that they don't feel like they need to vote. Quite frankly, I think that's an excuse. I think likely is that people either feel disenfranchised, feel that it doesn't make much of a difference, or don't feel like the campaigns are speaking to them very effectively. And then there are real difficulties in voting in the United States, from the way we ask people to register to the fact that we ask people to vote on a working day. So I think it's more those kind of things.
Is all of that different than other countries?
Yeah, it varies quite a bit. I mean, it's hard to talk about a single model in other countries, but we certainly have more complicated voter registration laws. We certainly make it more difficult. We have fewer polling places so that you get those long lines that you're seeing in the advance voting. And it's also the case that we spend a lot less per capita on the process of voting in the United States to make it more easy than in a lot of other countries.
You know, it seems that over the last, I don't know, maybe 6 months, that we're engaged. I mean, it could be a fluke, but it does seem like there's a lot of engagement. I wonder what gets us engaged. To be honest, the Iraq War never did get us engaged. It got us talking, but not engaged. I mean, I'm a child of the 60s. Vietnam sure as hell got us engaged very differently than the Iraq War. So what does get us engaged as citizens?
I think it's a combination of fear and hope that I think when things get really bad, that tends to focus the mind and to get more people interested in what's going on in public life and in politics. And we certainly have had a lot of that to focus on over the last 6 months. Actually, I think, to be honest, I think that this campaign, if you remember, this campaign started almost 2 years ago, and one of the great fears was it's starting so early that people would not remain interested. And I think over that whole period, certainly more recently, but over that whole period, there's been more interest than is usually the case. I think some of it is fear, as I said, but I also think it's you need to have potential leadership that that invigorates you, that gives you a reason to hope, gives you a reason to think, hey, if this really happens, things might be different, things might be better. And I think we're seeing a little of both of those in this campaign.
John, let me turn to you. Speaking of this election and the level of energy and excitement, there's a lot of factors in this election. We've got race, we've got gender, like I said in the opening. We've got youth. We've got soaring rhetoric, stark contrasts between the candidates, and pretty high stakes. I mean, we can argue that all of these factors have increased civic engagement in the election. What's your take about what's really energized the country around this election?
Well, I think one of the issues that has become important in the last few weeks is the extent to which the canvas of potential swing or battleground states has expanded. So if you're in a place like Pennsylvania, you know your vote is going to count. And you know people don't really quite know how to handicap what's going to happen on November 4th. You know, one of the other ways in which we might have this effect of a suppression in voter turnout is to have these states where, with the Electoral College structured the way it is, you know, people might imagine if they're in a decidedly blue state or a decidedly red one and they hold the opposite opinion, or even if they hold that opinion, probably doesn't make that much sense to, you know, bend over backwards to make sure you get to the ballot box, because we kind of already know how it's going to turn out. And I think one thing that's fascinating about seeing these two particular candidates battle it out is folks are really anxious about how America, especially these quote-unquote undecideds, are going to break with this pivot point between what Dele Carpini brings up as the distinction between a politics of fear and a politics of hope. Both can create traction for people. Both can motivate you to do things. But we have two campaigns that seem to kind of hang their particular platforms on one or the other of those potentialities.
I wonder, Michael, is there any research about which of those emotions generate the most energy? As a clinician, I could venture a guess.
Yeah, I mean, the research in this area is still, to my mind, a little bit underdeveloped. So I don't want to make this sound like this is scientific proof, but the evidence seems to suggest that fear motivates people to participate more than hope does. I have a feeling that in this election, that may be less true than normal. It's more of a gut feeling because of the way in which Obama has been able to really generate support much more than, at this stage of the game at least, it looks like, than McCain has. And he's done that on a message of hope. Now, underpinning that is clearly fear of the state of the economy, fear of the state of the environment, fear of the outcome of the war in Iraq, which I think still is important, even though it's been downplayed lately. So I think it's some kind of interaction in a way between having things to worry about and then actually having someone in front of you that gives you some hope that we can handle these things. But the research itself largely shows that fear is the motivator.
Yeah, and you know, when you think about it, fear is a more primal emotion. And I know as a clinician, and, you know, my colleagues who are developmental psychologists will say, you know, if you feel unsafe, nothing's going to change.
Sure.
That's got to be the emotion that that motivates you. If you're just tuning in, we're talking about the election tomorrow, why we vote, what motivates us, what gets us engaged, what are the emotions that... What are the issues that get us in the polling, in the voting booth, and get us to make up our minds? We're talking with two professors from the Annenberg School. John Jackson's here in the studio, and his most recent book's called Racial Paranoia, The Unintended Consequences of Political Correctness. I'm on the phone with Michael Della Carpini, and he's dean of the Annenberg School, and his most recent book is A New Civic Engagement, Political Participation, Civil Life, and the Changing American Citizen. Our number is 888-477-9499. Michael, you know, we talked to you before the show about the issues that affected decision-making. And when you answered our producer, I wasn't surprised by your answers. You said that it was where the candidates stand on issues. You talked about party affiliation. And the third factor you listed was personal quality.
That's right.
Attractiveness, so on and so forth. I was surprised by the order in which you gave them. The first was issues, and I would think attractiveness would be first.
Well, I think that's the coincidence of I wasn't putting them in order of their priority, I don't think. I think if you look at what really affects people's vote, especially in a presidential race, that personal qualities definitely are the ones that I think are the fundamental shaper of how someone is going to vote. But I want to make it clear that I don't think that that's just simply personal attractiveness in a superficial sense.
Right.
It's a real sense of, do you trust this person? Do you like this person? Do you think this person is going to be a good leader? Do you think he or she is going to make good decisions for you in difficult times? And so I think, without question, that sense of a candidate, even issues oftentimes run through that. So you may care about the environment, you may care about issues like the war in Iraq or the state of the economy, but you filter even your views on those issues through, and which of these candidates, based on who they are, do you think is going to handle them the best?
I like the word you used, attractiveness, because that's really what it is. It's kind of a pull towards that person. John, I want to turn to you, and as I think about recent candidates, Bush was more attractive than Gore or Curry. Gore and Curry were both pretty stiff to me. Gore was more relaxed. Not that I was more attracted to him politically, but he was just more attractive. Obama's more attractive to me than McCain. Reagan's attractiveness, I think, won him the election or helped contributed to the landslide. So, you know, in intimate relationships, things like pheromones and genetics come into play. I wonder if there's something underneath the issues that Michael was talking about that attracts us or turns us off, or the opposite.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I'm someone who tends to believe that doesn't necessarily have to be nature or genetics or biology to explain a powerful kind of social phenomena. We can learn cultural scripts, narratives that imagine certain definitions or operationalizations of attractiveness as being so second nature to us. They feel like they sort of were manna from on high. So I think we get taught to think about the ways in which we understand other people in these kind of pre-scripted or prefab ways. And so so even the idea that we want to have a beer with someone is a narrative. It's a cultural narrative that's about so much more than simply what is it intrinsically about that person that makes them shine or more media friendly than their competitor. I think we have to be more self-conscious and purposeful about mining our own presuppositions vis-a-vis some of these narratives and trying to look at culture a little bit more critically and skeptically.
And how do we do that? I mean, you talk about being more mindful about these scripts that we're not even aware of. Easier said than done.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think one of the things we can't do is simply rely on ideological cant to get us through it. So often what we're very good at doing is deconstructing our opponent's argument. So we can get into a debate and tell you all the reasons why our interlocutor has it wrong. We need to apply those very same skills to ourselves and our own arguments, not to make us that much more. Maybe ultimately it's even more manipulative. It says, well, I want to imagine what is going to come at me, what kind of critiques I'm going to get so I can anticipate them and resolve them. But I think it's really more about saying, if I'm serious, I can level the same kinds of analytical criticisms to the things I cherish and hold so dearly. And that's something that we should be able to do cognitively, even if emotionally, psychologically, it's a lot more threatening to us.
That's interesting, because my perspective on that as a clinician is the same thing, well, maybe the opposite, though it sounds the opposite, is your critic is to understand their heart and soul. But, I mean, we're going to the same place, mm-hmm, you and I. Mm-hmm. Let's see if we can get a phone call on before we have to take a break. We've got Georgette on the line. Georgette, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, I'm finding this utterly fascinating, so thank you for this show.
Yeah,
and I'm thinking back to the night of the 04 convention when Obama spoke, and I, like a lot of people, sat there thinking, who is this man, and can we have him be our president? I remember feeling, I mean, it seems hackneyed now, but I remember feeling just this very profound sense of rising hope. Like, is it possible that our country really could turn in the right direction? And so I do feel like hope has been my predominant emotion. And I think one of the things that evokes the most fear in me these days is, quite honestly, hearing the McCain campaign promulgate lie after lie after lie. That's disturbing, but what frightens me most is seeing and hearing people on, you know, on the media, television, whatever, on the radio, who believe those lies. To me, that's very, very frightening that there are people in this country who are very willing to completely ignore fact and just buy into utter lies.
Well, let me turn to Michael first,
mm-hmm,
and say that I am sure there are those who would argue pretty eloquently and say the opposite of what Georgette has said.
In terms of who's spinning what, or...
Yeah. I mean, I really just stole a page from John's book, but I want to hear...
Yeah, I mean, first of all, I should say that at one level, Georgette is correct, in that if you look at the websites that, including one that we have here at Annenberg, that try to parse the statements and ads of presidential candidates for their factual truthfulness, that while both sides have certainly stretched the truth at various points, that the bulk of that, the larger percentage of that, has in fact happened through the McCain campaign. So I'm saying that not as a partisan, but just looking at the numbers. I'll also say that when you look at public opinion polls, you do find that if you just ask people their perceptions, who do you think has been the most negative or the most the least straightforward in their ads and statements, that the Republican campaign is doing less well in the public mind than is the than are the Democrats. So there is something behind what Georgette is saying. But what's most interesting, I think, is that depending on where you start, what your political views are, what your ideology is, what your personal history is, the same person can look at the same ad or the same speech and think that they're hearing diametrically opposed things. So there is a certain amount of self-fulfilling prophecy that goes on. When we've already sort of established where we stand, we tend to filter new information through those same views.
Which it gets to what John was saying earlier. Georgette, thanks so much for your phone call.
Thank you for the show, and I want to thank the Annenberg Center for Fact Check.
Thank you.
Yeah, that's true. Thank you for that. So we do filter things through our own lens, and something that concerns me, and I'd like to hear both of you, your take on this before we take our break. Something that concerns me is there's more and more evidence that we surround ourselves, and I think you addressed this in your book, John, we surround ourselves with like-minded people, and now we've got the options to watch like-minded radio and TV stations, and we wind up reinforcing our own beliefs, and we wind up learning very little about anything other than our own thinking, and that's really not learning.
That's a good point. And one of the ironies, of course, is political scientists are showing us that it's those very people who stick close to their ideological home base who are the most active and participate and feel invested in civic life. Once people begin to connect out to a more heterogeneous political and ideological community, they tend to get a lot more afraid of the kinds of conversations that are possible. And so they think one thing we have to be very good at policing ourselves about is recognizing we're doing two things very well that don't serve us. One is to demonize the other. So it's okay to say, well, you know, every time I listen to McCain, I'm hearing, you know, lies, I'm hearing deceit, I'm hearing what isn't what I imagine to be true facts about the Obama campaign. But to say that and imagine that what that means is he corners the market on those kinds of strategies is to not be honest about how political campaigning works in the present. And even though I think Obama does a very good job at trying to stay ahead of some of these debates and keeping his head above the fray, doesn't mean everyone isn't engaging in the same kinds of very specific sorts of counter narratives and techniques to try to throw their opponent off their game. So I would say that. And then just lastly, the second really quick point, you know, I really do think we have to begin to talk honestly and openly about the extent to which we're terrified about other positions, right? There's something radical about feeling I hold on to something, I cherish it for dear life, and you don't believe it.
Well, you know, we did a show, I think it was 4 years ago, I'm sure of it, with social psychologists. And one of the things they found through controlled studies is that the more our anxiety goes up, our existential anxiety goes up, the more we clutch onto our beliefs. And this is what Obama was trying to say several months ago when he bollocksed it so badly about guns and religion. Yeah. But, I mean, the fact of the matter is the more anxious we get, the more insecure we get, the tighter we clutch on our beliefs. And what was interesting to me is that as anxiety goes up even higher, the more primitive our beliefs become, and they get reduced to things like good and evil, right and wrong, just that simple, which is what the 2004 election was all about. So it makes sense what you're saying, that, you know, we tend to get more anxious.
And if I could just add that I think that that's exactly right. What this conversation you both just had, I think, really hits the nail on the head. And that's what makes this election so interesting in some ways, is that if the predictions are correct in terms of turnout and the shifting of both individual votes and the bringing in of new voters and the change of the political landscape, it means something is happening right now that is forcing people to get past some of that and make decisions that they might not have made in a prior period, which is really fascinating.
Which is exactly what I want to talk about when we come back from our break. I want to talk about the so-called Bradley effect with Obama. I want to talk about Sarah Palin and Hillary and gender, too. And we've also got a full bank of callers. I've been selfish and hogging you guys, and we want to let our callers come in, too. We're talking about tomorrow's election, who votes, why, what it means, what the emotions are that drive these votes, and are we voting with an open mind and an open heart? My guests are Michael Delli Corpini. He's the dean of the Annenberg School at Penn. He was the director of public policy at Pew, and his most recent book is A New Engagement, Political Participation, Civic Life and the Changing American Citizen. I'm joined here in the studio by John Jackson. He's also at Penn Annenberg School, where he holds joint appointments as an associate professor of communications and anthropology. His new book is called Racial Paranoia, The Unintended Consequences of Political Correctness. I'm Dan Gottlieb, and you're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY 91 FM.
St. Mary Medical Center supports WHYY. Every day, St. Mary cancer specialists work to solve complex cases with innovative procedures. St. Mary specialists use tomotherapy with 3D imaging to help pinpoint cancer treatments without damaging surrounding tissue, destroy tumors from the inside out with HDR brachytherapy, and help revolutionize cancer diagnosis with PET CT. These procedures are being performed today at St. Mary Medical Center. It's your health. Expect more.
Debates? Check. Attack ads? Check. Last-minute polls? Check. It's been a long, historic campaign. Now it's up to you. Before you cast your vote, join us for a final look at who's winning where, memorable moments, what's at stake, and your calls. I'm Neil Conan, an election call-in special, Election Eve, from NPR News.
Tonight at 10 on WHYY.
And we're back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We are talking about tomorrow, and obviously we're looking at the emotions behind tomorrow. Why you're going to vote, who you're going to vote for. Is your mind open or closed, and to what extent do race and gender play into the elections? My guests are John Jackson. He's with the Annenberg School, and he holds joint appointments as an associate professor of communication and anthropology. His new book is Racial Paranoia, The Unintended Consequences of Political Correctness. Michael Deli Carpini is dean of the Annenberg School, and his most recent book is called A New Engagement, Political Participation, Civic Life, and the Changing American Citizen. So, John, let's talk about the Bradley effect here, or the lack thereof. For those who don't know it, in 1982, African-American Tom Bradley was way ahead in the polls in the race for governor of California. He lost that race, and people have theorized that people were not being honest with the pollsters. Has this theory ever been validated?
Well, I mean, one thing I would say is we can always imagine that afterwards, when we do our postmortems on these kinds of elections, if we need to make sense of anomalies between the exit poll numbers and the final vote tabulations, we tend to invoke this Bradley effect as one of the ways in which we might explain some of those discrepancies. One thing I would be clear about emphasizing here is I don't think we know if there's going to be a Bradley effect, and we won't be able to make sense of it for this election for a whole series of reasons until the smoke clears on November 5th. I think you're going to say something, Jim.
Yeah, with all due respect, I want to come back to my question. Do we know that there is even such a thing as the Bradley effect, or is it still a theory?
Well, I think it's definitely a theory that has some interesting sorts of empirical evidence supporting it.
Okay.
So besides Bradley, we can talk about Wilder. You know,
we
can talk about Dinkins in New York. And again, I don't know if Michael might know better if anyone studied this in a rigorous manner. But I think we have more than one instance of what seems to be this disconnect between exit poll numbers with an African-American candidate and the final voting scores.
One of your arguments, your critical arguments, is that explicit racism has now virtually been sanitized out of our dialogue over the years. And one of your arguments is that it goes underground and makes matters worse. But here's what I wonder. Is it a first step towards changing people's hearts and minds, or is it just window dressing, or is it somewhere in the middle?
Yeah, well, I think that's a perfect question. And I would say the answer is all about what we imagine political correctness to allow us to do. A lot of people want to think it's an end game. So once we clean up public discourse, we've done basically all we can do. So people won't feel offended. They can come to the table and do their work. And they think that's all we need to worry about vis-a-vis these issues of racial injustice and differentiation. And I want to say it's less of an end game than a starting point. Right? It's a kind of presupposition we need to have and bring to bear in our conversation. If we mistake it for the end game, if we mistake it for the finish line, then I think we get caught up in all of these really trivial attempts to sort of do a kind of gotcha psychology, a gotcha racial politics, trying to figure out if people are using euphemisms to really get at other more entrenched racialist and racist sorts of discussions. And so I feel like it's incredibly useful, but it's useful as a beginning point. It's not useful if we imagine we can put all of our eggs in that basket. And once we've done a good job at cleaning up public rhetoric around race, well, then we can sort of pat ourselves on the back and go on about the rest of our national business.
I think about race, it might be unfair, obviously through my own personal lens as a man in a wheelchair. So I think about it, you know, similar to disability and the ADA, which is, God, I wish I knew how many decades old. But what that did was force us into the community, and it forced the community to literally open doors so that we could join them. And it was thrust on people. And here, many decades later, that we are more part of the community. And you're right, it's a first step. But I'm having trouble seeing a downside to this first step?
Well, I think the downside comes when we continue to reproduce these racially segregated social networks, and we imagine that we can, if we just make it through the day with these very innocuous and euphemized conversations across racial lines, that once we get back to the safety and sanctity of our own homes and most intimate social spaces, then that's where we can vent. And I think the problem is, if that's the scenario, then we always have these kind of bad faith interracial interactions, where we're imagining people might say what they think we want to hear in the public sphere, because they know anything else will get them drummed out of town. But there are all these other spaces, these protected, private, intimate spaces, where we think that they might be engaging in some of the same kinds of rhetorics that have always gone on in America.
This dialogue reminds me of when I was hanging out with my black friends at Temple in 1966. The ones who came up here from the South to go to school came to Philly, and they said they felt safer in the South. And this is 1966, because they knew what was going on. It was clear down there. You know, the racism was clear. And here they're having to learn a whole new set of rules, and they're not all that visible. And that's essentially what you're saying.
Oh, as an anthropologist working in New York City right now, I invariably get the same discussion about long time. Sometimes native New Yorkers imagining when they get enough money and resources, they're going to move back down to the South. And they say that not because they, you know, romanticize old school versions of Southern racism. It's because at least they want to know who the quote unquote good guys and bad guys are. They want to know who really means them ill will and who is serious about their commitments to racial justice. And I think they think there's this duplicity in the North that isn't quite the same thing as what our mythologized notions of the South actually entail.
I don't know how many of your viewers would remember this, but there used to be a skit, I think it was with Eddie Murphy on Saturday Night Live, where he would be talking to his black friends, and then, or his white friends, but then when the whites all got together after there were no blacks, everything changed. And that's when all the goods were divvied up, that's when the real conversations took place. And in a funny kind of way, I mean, I think that's in some ways the environment we're in right now, which is, John is right, that for the most part, greatly for the most part, the more explicit versions of racism, at least as publicly expressed in public opinion polls or in the media, have been silenced. But the debate, the uncertainty, the literal uncertainty is, was it just silenced, and how or probably more accurately, how much of it was silenced, and how much of it has really changed? And that becomes very difficult to know when people are not talking to each other. Personally, for example, I find that when we deal with media commentators who make an explicit or implicit racially charged statement, that the way we deal with it now, which is to shut them off, fire them, lambast them, that's important. You got to do that. But it doesn't lead to a second stage, which is, so what does that mean? Why did that happen? What is that telling us? And I worry that we don't have enough either public or private discourse between and about race in the world that we live in right now.
You know, it's interesting. I listened to your review of the reactions of radio and our reactions to radio and TV commentators, and it just reminds me of my complaint about zero tolerance policies
In
school. You know, we're just being reactive, and then who's being the bully? And you know, in this case, it really is interesting, and it does cut off a dialogue. Let's go to the phones. I've been terribly selfish here. We've got Lisa on the line. Lisa, hi. You're on Voices. Lisa, I guess we have lost Lisa. John, one of the things you said was that this subconscious, this underground racism, is played out in this election, sometimes in Obama's favor and sometimes not. Tell us both sides.
Well, I think people often want to deploy race as a category that only works either positively or negatively. And I want to say it's always operating at cross purposes. There's some ways in which clearly Obama being an African-American candidate makes him this figure that stands against the grain of much of American racial history. He embodies in some ways what we imagine that transcendence of our racial past to entail. But I think at the same time, it's disingenuous to think that race is only this category that bolsters his political capital. It's also something he constantly has to navigate and negotiate in ways that aren't about race helping him, but about race being a decided hindrance, which is why it was so, I think, fantastic in February when he was finally forced to make a very intelligent but heartfelt speech about race in America. This was the quintessentially post-racial candidate trying to tell us race is still important even as we strive to get beyond it. And I think he's one of these people, as we all are, caught at this nexus between our still irrational investments in some of what race allows us to do and think about ourselves, even as we sort of strive along for a moment where race won't be able to sort of trap us the way it has historically.
I wanted to hear your reaction to that speech. We talked a little bit about it before we went on the air. To me, that speech was the most moving, most intelligent, most understanding and understandable speech, most grown-up speech on race that I'd ever heard in my, however, 50 years I've been listening to speeches. And he seemed to have genuine compassion for his generation of black man, for his father's generation, for both generations of whites, just genuine understanding and compassion. And the question I have is, that went away, that dialogue, and virtually silenced the Reverend Wright controversy. The question is, if he wins this election, what are your hopes that that dialogue will continue at that level?
Yeah, well, one joke I made at the time was I felt like he had read an advanced copy of Racial Paranoia, because some of his arguments about how to deal with some of these racial tensions are, I think, really line up well with some of the points I try to make in the book. You know, at the time I felt I didn't quite know how this movie would unfold, and we've had many plot turns this election season, but I did think that was one of these moments where it might cost him the election, right, if things don't get picked up in the way he would want by the media outlets, but that was still a moment where it would have been beneficial for us if he had to fall on his sword for the greater good. And so my hope is that actually, no matter what, McCain or Obama, we're going to have a lot of racial work to do, right? So no matter who wins this particular election, once we dig ourselves out of November 4th, we're going to have folks on both sides trying to figure out what to do with how race functioned, how it operated this election season. So we're going to be forced to talk about it. An Obama campaign means we're forced to talk about it. And we have someone in the White House who in some ways instantiates some of what that racial history actually entails.
I hate to oversimplify, but that sounds like good news.
I think it is.
One way or the other.
Well, I mean, my perspective clearly is the more discussions we have, the more serious, substantive, rigorous discussions we have about race, the better off we are. It's sometimes easier to just avoid the conversation because we don't know what our interlocutor will say. We don't know how it'll go. But I think it's better to make yourself vulnerable vis-a-vis some of these racial questions, because I think if we're committed enough to one another and to the body politic, we'll find a way to get through it and get through it and be the better for the experience.
To make yourself vulnerable, that is the answer to building bridges across all sorts of things. Let's squeeze another phone call in before our break. We've got Tina on the line. Tina?
Hello, Dan.
Hi, Tina.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Can hear you well.
Hold on one second. Very sorry.
You there?
Hi. Yes, I'm here.
Okay.
One thing that I've noticed in election coverage is the fact that so many news outlets tend to want to speculate and call the election first, you know, say we've decided who the winner is. And I just wonder if the guests could talk about any information they have regarding how such horse race coverage tends to maybe disengage people and make them more apathetic if they haven't voted, say, by 5 p.m. that day.
Michael, that's a great question. Tina, I'm going to turn it to you, Michael. You're the post-Pew guy.
Yeah, I think there are two pieces to that question. The first is the way in which the horse race coverage during the campaign itself affects the possibility, the way in which people react. And I think that the general answer to that is that a little bit of horse race coverage that kind of says this is close or not close or here's how your candidate is doing I think that adds something to the coverage. And so in its place, I don't think it's a problem. I think when it's all that happens, or when it dominates, which unfortunately in large aspects of American politics is the case, it does kind of get people's eyes to glaze over. That rather than, it goes back to the point we made earlier, it's not just that people want to hear about issues, but they want to hear about the candidates in the context of what they're going to do and what the state of the world is and what some of their opportunities might be to improve things. And I think that a engaging narrative about the state of the world and the issues we care about, like race, like the conversation we just had, is what really captures people's minds. And so I think in the context of the election itself, that too much horse race coverage can get people who are not political junkies turned off. On election night, the second part of the question, if when you have the exit polls being used to actually say, okay, that poll is closed in this state, we now have enough states where the polls have closed that we can predict the winner, the evidence is mixed, but I've looked at this, I've actually even written on this. My sense is that for people who live in areas where the polls are still open, that if you're driving from work and you were planning on heading to the polling place and you turn on your radio and you hear, oh, the election's been called, that for at least a significant percentage of people, they're going to just drive home. They're not going to vote in an election that's already been called for them. And so I do think that that early calling, which the networks have tried to rein in some but still do, can be really a problem.
Hmm. I hope that answers your question. Thanks for your call, Tina. The person you just heard answering that question was Michael Delicarpini. He's dean of the Annenberg School at University of Pennsylvania. He's also the author of A New Engagement, Political Participation, Civil Life, and The Changing American Citizen. I'm also joined here in the studio by John Jackson. He's also with the Annenberg School, and his most recent book is Racial Paranoia, The Unintended Consequences of Political Correctness. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY 91 FM.
Are you concerned about a loved one who is using drugs or drinking too much? You may be eligible to participate in research conducted by the Treatment Research Institute. As part of the study, you'll be asked to attend up to 14 sessions with a family trainer and will be compensated for completing questionnaires on a weekly and monthly basis. For details, 877-I-WORRY-2, 877-496-7792. The Family Training Program supports WHYY.
Widener University supports WHYY and announces a graduate open house Thursday, November 6th on Widener's main campus in Chester. Widener offers graduate degrees in business, higher education leadership, nursing, engineering, hospitality management, and clinical psychology, in addition to physical therapy, social work, liberal studies, public administration, and criminal justice. Full details at 1-888-WIDENER or widener.edu.
We're back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. What are we talking about? What else is there to talk about? We're talking about tomorrow, voting. Who votes? Why? How we vote? What drives us to vote? My guests are both from the Annenberg School of Communication at Penn, and we are very lucky to have them. Michael Delicarpini is dean, and he's written a new civic engagement, political participation, civil life, and A Changing American Citizen. Joined here in the studio by John Jackson, and his book is called Racial Paranoia, The Unintended Consequences of Political Correctness. Michael, I'd like to hear your take on Sarah Palin, but first I want to talk about Hillary.
Mm-hmm.
When she ran, the issue of gender was everywhere. She cried, and that was good.
That's right.
Or that was bad. She laughed, it was a cackle. I mean, gender was just everywhere with her. Why?
Well, it's historic, for one thing. You have a candidate who was the front runner for the Democratic presidential nomination, and given the state of the nation at that point, the likely next president, given what the polls were showing. And she was a woman, and I think that that's a historic moment. And so that gender was... was brought up is, and part of that campaign is not surprising, and she herself would use it, not inappropriately, as one of the themes of her campaign. I think what was, for me, more troubling was, though complicated, because Hillary brings with her a whole set of issues that are hard to parse out from gender itself, was the extent to which more explicit, I would say gender-biased statements and approaches could be used. And so the conversation about, you know, the her laugh and calling it a cackle, there isn't a word in the English language that's the equivalent of a cackle for a male. And I think those kind of statements, it's not that I don't think any statement should be eliminated, but the lack of a thoughtful kind of reflection on what it means that we were using that kind of language, I think was problematic. And for me, even though I don't think that she lost because of the way in which her gender was played out, I do think a conversation, not unlike the conversation John has called for so eloquently in his book about race, needs to be played out about gender as well in this campaign.
And in some respects, you know, I think to the Hillary campaign, in some respects, it is more complicated, more subtle than race.
It is. I think that there is some notions about sort of women and public life and women and what their makeup might mean for being in a national and international leadership position that still thrive in American politics and in American society. And so those notions that that there may be some limitations there or some issues that need to be thought about, they can be brought in without really stating them as much, because I think they are implicitly sort of charged and brought out just by the way in which the campaign itself plays out.
Yeah, boy, was that true with that campaign?
And in different ways with Sarah Palin, I think. You know, again, there was a lot going on. Her lack of experience, the fact that she was meant to represent more working class people, and her gender, but clearly, gender played a role in that, and it played a role in both cynical and real ways. Cynically, you could argue that the McCain campaign in part chose her, not only to shore up the conservative base, but to sort of counteract or to bring into the Republican fold some of the Hillary supporters who might have been disappointed at her not getting the nomination. But that's such a naive notion of how gender plays out,
of course,
that it can be problematic.
Well, let me bring up another issue that kind of hovers around Sarah Palin that never gets spoken about. And that is, you know, we talk about whether she's experienced enough. The question that never gets spoken about in the media, but always gets spoken about in private circles, is whether she's bright enough. And
yeah. And
this came out with Dan Quayle also, and it didn't come out. I mean, you know, it was there with Dan Quayle. So the question is, why does that not get spoken?
Well, I think this is kind of the gender. I mean, I don't know whether John would agree with this or not, but to my mind, it's the gendered equivalent of racial paranoia and political correctness. That when we, you know, there's something called the ecological fallacy, which is you take a general belief and you or truth, but does it apply in any individual case? You certainly do not want to, as a media person or a member of the Democratic campaign, to sound as if you're saying that Sarah Palin is not, quote, bright enough because she is a woman. So that kind of paralyzes people in some ways to explicitly make that comment, and rather than, therefore, it becomes implicit by the types of questions she gets answered. I mean, the people who have been most willing to do that in a funny kind of way have been the people, again, on Saturday Night Live and Tina Fey, because in humor you can sort of go a little bit further. But I think this is one of the traps we find ourselves in, is a difficulty between separating out a general prejudice, whether it's against blacks or women, and an application of a judgment about an individual person. And I think we're seeing the fear of stepping in it, in a sense, preventing people from having an open, honest discussion about that.
Well, let me turn to you, John, and raise a question about maybe this issue about intelligence maybe beyond race or gender, because we didn't bring it up with Dan Quayle directly either. Is there some hidden thing about saying you're not intelligent enough, in my opinion? I mean, that's a pretty hot thing to say to someone. That's very politically incorrect.
Yeah. I mean, I do think, besides the comedian, Dean Della Carpini, besides the comedians who have done a very good job being quite adamant about stressing this sort of intelligence argument, along with an experience argument, you know, some of the really elite right-wing columnists and pundits have also been very good at saying part of her issue is, you know, she's not smart enough to be president. And I think, you know, one thing we have to recognize also is when we talk about gender, Palin is useful as, you know, what anthropologists would say is something to think with, because in some ways she's the anti-Clinton, the anti-Hillary mm-hmm. Clinton. You know, she's someone who doesn't have the whole matrimony issue, right? One of the critiques of Hillary was she sort of came into this position by way of her husband. So already that was a red flag for some people who didn't want to like her. The second thing is she's incredibly charismatic, and Hillary Clinton is very bright. She's a very good politician, doesn't have the charisma that Bill can deploy. And I think that's another big distinction between them. Then I think there's something about the way in which Hillary can articulate an argument in a sustained way, no matter what kind of contextual situation she's negotiating, that's very different from what Sarah Palin's used to. And I think we do have to be very careful about making an argument about intelligence qua intelligence. In some ways, we don't even know what that is often, right? We don't even know how to define it, how to operationalize it. Clearly, she has to be a smart person to have succeeded the way she has, right? To get to the point where she's, you know, potentially going to be the next vice president, I mean, she has a modicum of something. That's why I don't buy the arguments about George W. Bush not being bright. At some level, we have to talk about what do we mean by intelligence? Because if we reduce it to the narrowest kind of academic definition of what it means to be an intelligent person whose life is a life of the mind, then I think we miss all the various ways in which we can be intelligent as a social, political, intellectual animal that aren't reducible to that one specific kind of stereotypical definition of what intellect entails.
Mike? Michael?
Yeah, I want to say I really agree with that. I mean, the whole concept of intelligence is, as you know, better than the two of us probably, fraught with all kinds of limitations. There's multiple forms of intelligence. There's emotional intelligence. There's sort of social intelligence. And so, and the thing that makes it really difficult when we're talking about a presidential campaign is that we're one step removed. We want to be able to evaluate these people using the standards that we use for people that we know and people that we interact with.
And we are, and you're right, we are far, far, far from knowing them. I have to close the show on that note. We're way out of time. I want to thank you both so much. It's been a great show. My guests have been Michael Della Carpini. He is the dean at the Annenberg School. I'm joined here in the studio by John Jackson, associate professor of communications and anthropology at Penn. And he's written Racial Paranoia. Well, the engineer for today's show has been Kevin Griffin. Elizabeth Perez-Luna is the executive producer for Radio Content. Mike and Scott's the executive producer of the show. We are co-produced by Elisa Walters and Gita Simons. I'm Dan Gottlieb. Have a great week, my friends.